and I present the Bible for the Day of the Air. Read each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for the Day Incorporated and the Dean Bergon Society with International Studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 837. 837 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Bergon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible, 9/8 printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible? Or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your defined King James Bible published for the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Not another Bible in the world like it. Order yours today, the defined King James Bible. Call us at 1-800 and get one for yourself and for your friends. All right, we continue on a new subject this month. We're going to take this the next couple of months, I'm sure, but it's called A Critique and an Analysis of the Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's a hardback book by Edward Miller, who was an associate of Dean John William Bergon many years ago. This Guide to Textual Criticism has been reproduced and reprinted by the Dean Bergon Society recently, and in fact it was reprinted back in 1979. It's our first reprint of our Dean Bergon Society, and we want to tell you a little bit about it because it's very simple, very important indeed. Let me read from the foreword first of all. Introduction to the 1979 reprint, and of course this one's a hardback, the other one was a paperback. We've enlarged the type, it's easier to read, it's very, very helpful indeed. You have to get a copy, simply call us, we'll tell you how to get your copy. It's number 743. Well, let me read from the foreword. The Dean Bergon Society, Incorporated, which is Box 354, Collingswood, New Jersey, gives great praise to God for His blessings upon our organization, which began November of 1978 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is our 25th year, my friends. Project number 9 of the Dean Bergon Society is, quote, to acquire, print, sell, and distribute other sound books by the scholars who lived around the time of Dean John William Bergon, who defended the traditional Masoretic Hebrew text, the traditional received Greek text, and the King James Bible. That's from the Dean Bergon News, January 1979. It's available. Then I say this present reprint of A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller is the Society's first in a series, hopefully, of books which furthered its purpose in defense of traditional Bible texts, as the Lord raises up the funds and supplies our needs. My friends, this is the 9th book, by the way, that the Dean Bergon Society has reprinted. 9 books that we've reprinted and made available that stand with us for the King James Bible and its underlying Hebrew and Greek texts. We continue in the foreword. The significance of this present volume by Miller lies in the fact that Edward Miller was Dean John William Bergon's understudy and co-worker. He published at least 2 of Bergon's works posthumously, that is, after Dean Bergon died, namely the traditional text of the Holy Gospels, that's BFT number 1159, and Causes of Corruption of the Traditional Text, that's BFT number 1160. These are available. If you're interested in getting them, give us a call, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. Then, coupled his own personal talents and abilities for this textual work with the close personal training from Dean Burgon, the master himself. This book is brief and yet profoundly needed to offset the unfounded and unscriptural books on textual criticism which have been based upon the faulty and false Westcott and Hort Greek textual theories in whole or in part. We hope and pray that a copy of this book might find its way into every library of every college, university, Bible institute, seminary, and other schools of higher learning, every other school, into every library of every pastor in the country, into every library of every church in the country, and into the hands of every scholar and layman alike, whose sincere and genuine desire is to ascertain, amidst the false beacon lights which have been especially shining since 1881, that's when Westcott and Hort began their false text, that we could have the solid and proper principles on which to determine the exact words of the New Testament scriptures. And for other books in the reprint series, as they come out, see the order pages in the back of the book, or write Dean Burgon Society, Collingswood, New Jersey. So that's the foreword of the book. And we've got many who have been trained in the false Westcott and Hort type of theory, and this training is done even by not just the Roman Catholic Church, not just the modernistic liberal denominations and schools, not just the new evangelical schools such as Dallas Theological Seminary, where I was trained for 5 years in residence, but also many of the fundamental schools. The fundamental schools are also falling into the same false Greek text and theory of that text as do the ones in Roman Catholicism, liberalism, and new evangelicalism. The four leading fundamentalist friends, you might say, schools, we believe in many of the things that they teach, their separation and various other things, but the leading fundamentalist schools, as I've mentioned many times on this broadcast, are starting with Bob Jones University, the Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, and Central Baptist Seminary. Those are the four leading fundamentalist schools that are leading people astray and teaching them the false text of Westcott and Hort and the false theory behind that text. And that's why one of the very important things that we want to bring out in this guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament, that we could take away these people who, not people, but take away their views and to refresh the proper view of what the scripture might be. So Edward Miller, he dedicates this book to those who, whether in the outset of the work or at the close, have kindly given help or acknowledgments. This little treatise is gratefully inscribed, and with the prayer that it may minister in some degree, however humble, to the ascertainment and acceptance of the genuine words of Holy Scripture. That's what we want, the genuine words. In the New Testament, that's the Greek words. Old Testament, it's the Hebrew words. Well, here's the preface, reading for the preface, talking about this guide to textual criticism, the New Testament, Dean Burgon Society's latest reprint. The ensuing treatise, says Edward Miller, is intended to be a brief manual on the textual criticism of the New Testament for ordinary students of the Bible, and to induce those who may be disposed to enter more deeply into the important subject of it to prosecute further research in the plain introduction of Dr. Scrivener, the learned works of Dean Burgon, and in other well-known sources of information upon textual criticism. In other words, what he's saying is that this is a primer. This is an ABC book. This is the beginning. Later on, go on into the book, The Plain Introduction of Dr. Frederick Scrivener, which we have reprinted here at the Dean Burgon, at the Bible for the Day, and also the works of Dean John William Burgon. We've reprinted 5 of his books that Dean Burgon Society has, and they're available. The first book we reprinted was The Last 12 Verses of Mark, and then we printed, reprinted the Revision Revised. Then we reprinted the traditional text, and then the causes of corruption, and finally Inspiration and and inspiration of the scriptures, the things that we gave the apostles one here as well, the guide to textual criticism of the New Testament. Inspiration and Interpretation, that's that book, that fifth book of Dean Burgos. Let me continue the preface. The footnotes will ordinarily indicate how much I have been indebted to the labors of other men in a work which pretends to be little more than a faithful representation of stores accumulated by the learned and an independent estimate of the conclusions drawn by them. To the Dean of Chichester, that's Dean John William Burgon, I am indebted for many previous hints which I have found invaluable during my prosecution of a task both laborious and difficult. I might just say the original edition of this came out in 1886 and reprinted July of 1979, then in the hardback edition July of 2003. Just might want to say in 1886, and that was 3 years after Dean Burgon's death. Dean Burgon died in 1883, and Edward Miller got this book out 3 years after his death to sum up what he believed in many areas. He says, the undertaking of it, this book, was originally pressed upon me from without, and I myself convinced that some such assistance as is offered to the general reader is greatly needed at this time. But I lay down my pen with the conviction derived from the accomplishments of my work that every reader who really understands how great questions at stake must bestow on the problem which has suddenly emerged into promise a considerable amount of unprecedented attention. And what are you saying here? This subject of textual criticism, this subject of knowing what the proper words of the New Testament, this we're getting at mainly, it's not the Hebrew aspect, but to understand what the real words are and how they've arrived and been arrived and been led to accept, people led to accept them, this takes time. It also takes unprejudiced attention, considerable amount of individual attention as well. So it's not a simple subject by any means, and especially since many of us have learned textual criticism from the wrong approach, it must take many, many hours to change the views of many who have been brought up wrongly, like I have been brought up wrongly. I was brought up under Dallas Theological Seminary's tutelage. They laid down the Westcott and Hort exact Greek text that they came out of 1981. I began my studies of the Greek language, of course, in classical Greek and Latin. I majored in that in the University of Michigan, 1945 to 1948. But when I went to Dallas Seminary in 1948, I was given the Westcott and Hort text, and that's all we used. And they didn't even bring up the fact there was a Textus Receptus. Never mentioned the thing. Just went ahead, this is it. And so I had to unlearn this. I was in the dark for over 20 years. Over 20 years. And finally, by reading and studying, I came to the conclusions that I was taught wrong as far as the text of the New Testament was concerned, the Greek text. I majored in New Testament literature and exegesis, which was the Greek department of Dallas Seminary at the time. But that still did not give me the truth. So it does take an individual and unprejudiced attention, considerable amount of it, in order to change, especially those that have been brought up wrongly. And this was my case, and I'm glad that the Lord has led me otherwise. And right now, after all these years, from 1971 approximately to the present time, over some 33 years, the Lord has given me many hours to read, to study, to write, and to publish books and materials and tapes on this subject. Let me continue from the preface. The student will be able to see with which of the contending parties the truth must lie. He must approach the problem in a calm, judicial spirit, must require proof as far as proof is attainable, instead of putting up with hypothesis, and above all, must never cease to exercise a large amount of vigilant sagacity, that is wisdom, in fact, of common sense. My thanks also is due to the Reverend R. Hutchinson, M.A., Rector of Woodinton, the late scholar of Exeter College, Oxford, who has kindly helped me in correcting the proof sheets. That's from the Buckner Rectory, and it's 1885 from Edward Miller. Published in 1886, written in 1885. Original. So you see, we're talking about a book that's written many, many years ago, but it's a book that we felt was necessary for reprint and understanding. Well, the contents. Let me just go over the contents of this Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller. The chapter 1 is the introduction, the importance of the subject. Chapter 2 deals with the history of textual criticism. The first part is the earlier stage and the earlier stages, that is, its infancy and childhood. Chapter 3, again, the history of textual criticism. And the second part, contemporary growth, such as youth, and then signs of coming maturity. Chapter 4 of the book deals with the school of extreme textualism. Now that's, of course, the origin of it. It goes into the masters by Lachman and then the theories of Drs. Westcott and Hort, the refutation of it. And then Chapter 5, the rival school. That's the tenets of the rival school. And that's the one that Dean Burgon accepts and Edward Miller accepts. Then in Chapter 6, the history of the traditional text till the era of Chrysostom, and gives a history in that way. And then Chapter 7 deals with the history of the traditional text from the era of Chrysostom till the invention of printing. And then Chapter 8 deals with the materials of criticism, namely the uncial or capital letter manuscripts, the cursive or flowing hand manuscripts, and the lectionaries, those portions that were read in churches through the years, the versions or early translations, and the ecclesiastical writers, and some of the quotations there. Then Chapter 9 deals with the principles of criticism. Then in the appendices, he has a total of 7 appendices: the last verse of Mark, the first words from the cross, the record of the strengthening angel, and the bloody sweat, the angelic hymn, the doxology in the Lord's Prayer, the Son of God's eternal existence in heaven, and then God manifest in the flesh. So these are some of the appendices. Let's go then to Chapter 1 of this Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. Now, before we begin, this is an introduction. It talks about the importance of the subject. Before I go into this, let me simply say this. This subject, we believe, has been settled as far as the we're concerned. Dean Burgon's work and other people have worked on it. We believe that the text that underlies our King James Bible is a text that we should support and we should accept and we should hold to for the foreseeable future, if not forever. It's the text on which our King James Bible is based. Now, we don't have the opportunities, the time, the knowledge to undertake any corrections of that traditional text, either the Hebrew Old Testament or Greek New Testament. And the Westcott and Hort people have done it in the wrong way. The so-called majority text people have done it in the wrong way, improper way. They have not done everything that Dean Burgon said we have to do if there's going to be any changes, major changes of the Textus Receptus on which our King James Bible is based. They haven't done it right. I have an entire book on that, Dean Burgon's idea of correction and change, and they haven't been able to meet that change. So we're settled on what the verses are. But this book here deals with the principles, the guide to the textual criticism, and shows how the Westcott and Hort principles have been failures. And this is why we have it. But let me just simply say, this is not a light subject. This is somewhat of a heavy subject. It's a subject of interest. But here's the importance to the reader and the importance of the subject. In the introduction, let me simply begin by reading that. What is the genuine Greek? What the true text of the New Testament? Which are the very words which were written by the evangelists and apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ under the inspiration of the Holy Ghost? Have we up to this period, he's writing, remember, in 1885, have we up to this period received and used for the information of our faith and the guidance of our lives a form of text which in a vast number of particulars, many of which are of great importance, has been fabricated by the device or error of men? End of quote. I mean, to pause right here. That's exactly what they were faced with in 1881 when the Westcott and Hort False Greek Text came out. Something fabricated by men. Fabricated by men. Let me continue the introduction, the importance of the subject. This question has been raised in the research of recent times, which has brought to light an amount of evidence residing in ancient copies and translations of the New Testament that has led many eminent scholars to reject as being in their estimation corruptions of the pure text various passages which have endeared themselves to Christians in the course of centuries, thus according to principles largely adopted. Now he goes into some of the things that the false Westcott and Hort people, even of our day, even these fundamentalist schools and colleges that are friends in other areas but enemies in the idea of the Bible, that is Bob Jones University, Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, Central Baptist Seminary, that's what these schools, because of their false teaching in regard to what the New Testament scriptures are, because of their use of the Westcott and Hort type of text, call it the United Bible Society text, call it the Nestle Island text, but it's the Westcott and Hort text. And because of this, and even in 1885, beginning with Westcott and Hort, Doctors Westcott and Hort of the Anglican Church in 1881, they have jettisoned, they've thrown out the following passages. They don't think that they're sincere and honest and true. And then Edward Miller, by the way, Edward Miller is from the Church of England, an Anglican, same as Dean John William Burgon. I'm a Baptist. I don't agree with all the Anglican doctrine, but he was a fundamental Anglican, if you could speak of one of that terminology. He was a fundamentalist Anglican. He believed the Anglican doctrines. As I say, we don't hold to all those doctrines of the church in the way that was formed and the bishops and various other things. But he believed the scriptures and the doctrines of the faith, just like Dean John William Burgon did. But here are some of the passages that Westcott and Hort and their text based upon B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai text, have thrown out and cast suspicion on. A, the last 12 verses of Mark. They've just thrown it out. They can be cast aside. And an abrupt ending made after the words, "For they were afraid." Number B, letter B, in the Lord's Prayer, as given by Luke 11:2-4, the following clauses must be excised and thrown out by these false theories. Quote, "Our Father which art in heaven," and then, "Thy will be done, as in heaven, so on earth." And also, "But deliver us from evil." Those have to be thrown out because they use the false Greek text of Westcott and Hort, B and Aleph. Letter C, the doxology must be omitted from the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6:13, and so all the record of it lost in the Gospels. Letter D, verses 43 and 44 must be no longer reckoned in the 22nd chapter of Luke, and thereby the account must disappear of the strengthening angel and the bloody sweat, as well as the evangelical record of the agony in the garden. Letter E, the first of the Lord's seven sayings from the cross, Luke 23:34, must be regarded as unauthentic, namely, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That's just taken out because Westcott and Hort's false text takes it out. And these are things that are doubted by the New International Version, New American Standard, Revised Standard, New Revised Standard, Today's New International, and so on. And finally, letter G. Now let's see, letter F, first of all, letter F. Also, Luke's assertion of the ascent from heaven, or into heaven rather, ascent into heaven, Luke 24:15. An omission of the more importance, because Mark's account of the same event, which included also the session at the right hand of God, is supposed, under these principles, to have vanished with the last 12 verses of his gospel. So, the ascent to heaven in Luke chapter 24, verse 15 is gone. Finally, letter G, Luke's recital of the institution of the Holy Sacrament, that's the Lord's Supper, Luke 22:19-20, must be lost as far as this is my body. They just take that right out. Now, these seven instances, which might be multiplied extensively by the addition of other omissions, such as the descending angel and the cure wrought in the pool of Bethesda, of the last cry in St. Mark's description of the centurion's faith, of the greater part of Luke's account of the inscription on the cross, of Peter's visit to the sepulchre in the same gospel, of the salutation, peace be unto you, of the Lord, showing his hands and his feet, of the word broken, whereby a gash is made and a blank space left in Paul's grand version of the institution of the Lord's Supper, and others too numerous to recount here. In other words, these are doubted passages because of the false Greek text of Westcott and Hort. These are doubted, and these are questioned. And so he says not to do more than allude to startling statements, such as our Lord's side was pierced before death, and that the sun was eclipsed at its full, instead of darkened by the Lord, just simply eclipsed. They may teach all who revere and love the Word of God what precious points are at stake. Now, Adrian Miller just gives out some of these things that are omitted by these people, the Westcott and Hort false books. And he says these are precious words, precious portions of Scripture that are taken out. Every one of these are still in our King James Bible. We have no question but what these are genuine places. They should remain. They should not be questioned by footnote or any other way. They should not be removed completely, as some of these modern versions have removed them. I'm talking about the New International Version. I'm talking about the New American Standard Version. I'm even talking about the study edition, the footnote edition of the New King James Version, in the footnotes at least. I'm talking about the Revised Standard, the New Revised Standard, today's New English Version, and today's New International Version. I'm talking about the Christian Standard Version of the Holman Broadman Southern Baptist edition that's come out recently. All of these things. Well, Edward Miller goes on. But let's pause right here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collinswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We hope to see you next time, same station. And we're going to continue talking about this guide to textual criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, a very, very important subject and an important guide as to what our real Greek New Testament text really is. See you then, same time, same station. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for the Day of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for the Day Incorporated and the Dean Murgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 838. 838 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on our question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@biblefortoday.org. We'd be love to have you to talk to us and like to hear from you. Like to get our book called Defending the King James Bible, now in its eighth printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. And have you received your Defined King James Bible yet, published for the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, not another Bible in the world like it. Choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? Well, we're continuing this week on the Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, Associate of Dean John William Burgon. This is a hardback edition reprinted by our Dean Burgon Society. It's available. You ought to get a copy. It's number 743. Number 743. Simply ask us how you may receive your copy. Call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Now, we're still in the introduction of the book, The Importance of the Study. Edward Miller has given us much. Last week we talked about it, but now he says this on page 3. If the changes advocated by the modern school, now that modern school, my friends, the school of Westcott and Hort, the school of the Roman Catholic Church, it's the school of the modernist liberal apostate Protestant churches, it's the school of the new evangelicals, and it's the school of altogether too many fundamentalist schools and colleges. I'm talking about fundamentalists in the doctrines that we believe in, but they're wrong in this area of the Bible and its texts. I'm talking about our four fundamentalist famous friends, schools like Bob Jones University. I'm talking about Detroit Baptist Seminary. I'm talking about Central Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary. They've got this New Testament Greek text all wrong. They're using the Westcott and Hort Nestle Island text or United Bible Society text, and they're undermining the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible and the 8,000 differences between those two texts. 8,000 differences, and Dr. Jack Mormon has published these 8,000. We have them available here. Our Bible for Today has reprinted this huge, over 500 or 600 pages. He gives you chapter and verse, the Greek words, the English words, the false text, the true text, 8,000 plus differences. And so, if the changes, Edward Miller says, advocated by the modern school leave enough behind in Holy Writ to support without doubt the essentials of the faith of Christendom, yet they are so numerous and so momentous in themselves as to produce a painful wrench in earnest affection which have attached themselves to words familiar and deeply loved from childhood. And to prove that, at least at first appearance, general and special attention should be directed to what may really be a corruption of the Holy Scriptures. And that's exactly what these changes are, advocated by Westcott and Hort and the false versions of the New International, Today's New International, New American Standard, the New American Standard, and Revised Standard, New Revised, and others. Besides this, says Dean Edward Miller, the number of alterations amounting in the modern, most moderate of the new recensions to 5,337, that's the most modern of the recensions now, reveals the formidable nature of the operations that are threatened. Well, the 5,337 changes, Dr. Jack Mormon has come up with 8,000 exact changes between the text, the so-called revised text, and the received text. And Edward Miller continues, if the majority of these alterations are small, it must be remembered that the instance taken in one which presents much less change than the other editions of the New Testament. Enough is shown to establish beyond doubt that it is the duty of all Christians who take an intelligent interest in the controversies of their day, not to sit at as still as they should sit, and not to sit still when such concerns are in jeopardy. In other words, he says, I don't just stay in the sidelines in this battle. You Christians that are listening to my voice on the radios and in the internet and places all over the world that are listening to this broadcast, I want you to stop sitting still. That's what Edward Miller wants you to do. Stop sitting still. This is a momentous and a great battle. You must engage in it. You must have the facts first and then battle with those facts and with that truth. And so the majority of these alterations are small. That's true. Some of them don't make a lot of difference, but there are 8,000 of them, small and large. Some of them are very large indeed. Then Edward Miller continues in his introduction, the importance of the study. Yet at the present time, there are comparatively few persons, clerical or lay, who have an intelligent acquaintance with the grounds on which this important question rests. In other words, they don't know really the basis of facts. That's what this book is about, the guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament. They don't know where it rests. They don't know the basis. They don't know the beginning and the end. And then Miller says, the subject at first sight presents a forbidding aspect to most minds. The exceedingly valuable treatises on it are too full of learning and too long for such as are not really students to master. And the hurry and haste of modern life demand a simpler mode of treatment. And my friends, unquote, that simpler mode of treatment is found right here in this guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament. And then Edward Miller goes on, and he says, it is therefore with the hope of presenting the chief features of textual criticism, or such elementary considerations as are immediately involved in determining the Greek text of the New Testament, to readers in a clear and not uninteresting way, that in deference to the urgent solicitations of some who enter deeply into the controversy, the composition of the little treatise, this little treatise, has been undertaken. In other words, he's quite a long-winded writer, you might say, a lot of big words, but just hang with him. Hang with him and hang with me as I try to explain all these things. He says we've got to have a brief synopsis of the problem. That's what his guide to textual criticism of the New Testament is. Then Edward Miller continues, inexpressibly dear to all true Christians, whether they range themselves on the one side or the other, must be the very expressions, the sentences, the phrases, the words, and even the rhythm and the accents of the genuine utterance of the Holy Spirit of God. The general sentiment of Christianity has applied with plenary enlargement the warning given at the close of the last book of the Bible against addition or omission. And it says, let no man add to the words of the Holy Scriptures or detract anything from them, said one of the most renowned of the church fathers. He's quoting from Athanasius. And that's, of course, what we want. We don't want to add. We don't want to subtract. And that's what the false Westcott Greek text has done. Mostly they subtract. Occasionally they add, but mostly they subtract. Let them fear the woe which is destined for them who add to or take away, was the consentient admonition of another. That's Tertullian, one of the early church writers. Well, Edward Miller continues, the leading points in the contention on either side will be given in the narrative. The questions in debate are questions of fact and must be detected by the facts of history, the origin and nature of the documents on which they depend, and due regard to the proportion of the Christian faith. that cannot be settled piecemeal. Now, that's an interesting point. These issues can't be settled piecemeal. In other words, just a little at a time, piece here and piece there. All the counts of the case must be before the court. All the counts, all the details, in other words, must be before the court to decide. An attempt will therefore be now made to represent with all candor the chief grounds on which opinion should rest, as they have been set forth in the career of the science of textual criticism, in the principal arguments employed by the rival schools of the present day. Now, he was writing here in 1885, and 1881 is when the False Text of Westcott and Hort came out. He's talking about in his own day. And we've got a battle on our hands today as well, the rival schools, and the rival schools of the present day, in the history, he says, of the transmission of the New Testament from age to age, and in the leading materials of criticism. And it will be our duty to deduce in conclusion the main principles that ought to regulate critical operation in any endeavor to revise and remodel the sacred text. End of quote. That's his introduction. That's the importance of the problem. That's chapter one. Let's move on then to Edward Miller's chapter two, the history of textual criticism. The first part is the earlier stages, infancy, formative period of the received text, childhood, the critical operations before 1830. So let's take up chapter two. Edward Miller says, "The science of sacred textual criticism is the child of circumstances and has been fostered by the zeal and industry of learned men. It has arisen from the large number of existing copies of the New Testament, which has now, as far as inquiry has extended, reached no less than some 2,000. Well, that was in 1885, as Edward Miller was writing. The number of copies now that we have in existence, either in whole or in part, is 5,255 as of 1967, and there's probably been over 100 more since then. So it's gone from over 2,000 to over 5,000 plus, even as many as 5,500 at this time. We continue. These primary sources of information are further augmented by translations into various languages. Now, these are the early versions. So you have the manuscripts, and you have the translations in other languages, and also by quotations occurring in the works of early ecclesiastical writers. Now, these would be called the early church fathers. Now, these were ecclesiastical writers. These were leaders in the churches, where they debated and wrote back and forth on their points of view, and in so doing, they either alluded to or quoted directly from the scriptures. And the scriptures that they had in their hands, the documents, the manuscripts, the text, is a very important contribution to the truth of what really should be in the New Testament. And so we have these three sources, and we have the text themselves, that is the manuscripts, the early translations or versions, and the quotations or allusions by the early ecclesiastical writers or church fathers. Then Edward Miller says, accordingly, as these numerous witnesses render evidence which is discordant, that is contradictory, in thousands of particulars, there is plainly a need of guiding principles and of a recognized system in estimating that testimony. Thus, the science of textual criticism has been gradually growing almost since the time of the invention of printing. Of course, that was about 1455, along that line. Miller continues, and as was natural, its growth and tendency have been largely influenced from time to time by the materials that research and discovery have continually produced. When new manuscripts have been brought to light, or the verdict of the old ones has been ascertained by the slow process of collation, that is, getting them all together and comparing them, the importation of fresh evidence has necessarily affected the conclusion previously drawn, the conclusions. A science depending upon facts that can be ascertained only after protracted processes of investigation cannot but be late in coming to maturity. In other words, it takes time based on facts. It takes time to come to maturity. At the present time, he's writing, as I say, 1885. This was published in 1886 originally. At the present time, by the way, Dean Burgon had died 2 years previously, 1883. He's writing in 1885. At the present time, hundreds of manuscripts are waiting to be collated, that is, compared one with another. That's collation. Various versions need re-editing, that is, the early translations of the Bible. And indexes have to be provided of the quotations of the fathers, these early church fathers. And Dean Burgon did provide these, and Edwin Miller helped him, I'm sure, and many on his staff. In fact, those quotations or allusions of the early church fathers are 16 folio volumes Dean Burgon put together. They're in the British Museum to the very present time. And there are over 86,000 allusions or quotations by these early church writers. And the indexes have been made by Dean Burgon. We haven't got the indexes translated or reprinted because they're very difficult. And Dr. Jack Mormon, who lives over there in London, England, has told us that it would not be a good thing to do. Very expensive. They're color-coded. We'd have to have colored films of it. And then we'd have to have the right or added editions of the actual church fathers' quotations as to what they were. So the whole process is very difficult indeed. But indexes have to be provided of the quotations. If it is to be said upon controversial points can be collected with exact accuracy. So he says a number of things have to be done before you'd be exact in the accuracy as to what the words are or should be. Edward Miller continues. Besides that, the relative value of the various classes and subdivisions of evidence cannot yet be determined so as to meet with universal acceptance. Then he says four periods in the history of textual criticism may be distinguished so far as it's been yet involved, as far as it's been involved so far, namely, infancy, childhood, impetuous youth, and incipient maturity. Now, he's writing this in 1883, and we're making this broadcast in 2003. So you see, a number of years, 120 years, have elapsed since he wrote this, but at his vantage point, he's got these four periods: infancy, childhood, impetuous youth, and incipient maturity. The first division is the infancy. He's going to take up the infancy of this textual criticism, and here's what he says. Although a folio edition of the Bible in Latin was printed by Gutenberg as early as A.D. 1455, now that's where the invention of printing was there in 1455 by Gutenberg, Johann Gutenberg. None in the original Greek appeared till the beginning of the 16th century, in other words, in the 1500s. It's only started with Latin, 1455. The demand at the time was not great. Greek scribes depended upon employment for their living, abounded in Europe after the capture of Constantinople in 1453. So 1453 was the capture of Constantinople. 1455 was the first Latin Bible and version by Gutenberg. So printing would be much more difficult in the unfamiliar Greek type, and the prevalence of clever and graceful abbreviations made the work of copying at once more rapid and more artistic. Therefore, half a century passed before the church saw the accomplishment of a task so formidable, of which the want was at once so easily and so well supplied. So this was a formidable task. This was a difficult task. It was a necessary task. It was a task that would make it possible to have these scriptures in the Greek text copied and made available for people to use and to read. Well, here's the first one. Number one, he lists the infancy. He's going to list two or three different ones that began this process. Number one, Cardinal Ximenes. Now, he was a Roman Catholic cardinal, founder of the University of Alcala. Alcala, A-L-C-A-L-A, that's in Spain, and an eminent patron of literature, was first in the field. He was the first to take up the Greek New Testament, not just Latin, but Greek. In the course of his advancement, he had passed from a dungeon. He had passed from a dungeon where he had spent 6 years of his life to the Archbishopric of Toledo and the Regency of Castile. So apparently he was a prisoner. I wasn't aware of that until I read this. He was a prisoner for 6 years, finally became the Archbishop of Toledo, Roman Catholic Cardinal Ximenes. And in his later days, laid out the vast income of the see, that is his Roman Catholic see, upon charitable or public objects. Now, having collected together as so many manuscripts as he could, he set Lopez de Stumica and other learned editors to the work in 1502. In other words, Stumica was one of the ones that helped him, on which he expended more than 50,000 ducats, or about 23,000 pounds. That's English pounds. I don't know what that would translate in English into dollars, but quite a sum. It was intended to commemorate the birth of Charles V. But many years elapsed ere the completion of the New Testament in Greek and Latin, January 10th, 1514. So this is the first Greek New Testament that's been printed. This is the infancy of the Greek New Testament by Cardinal Ximenes, and it's the Complutensian Polyglot is what it's called, from Complut or Alcala, Spain, and it had the Latin on one side, the Greek on the other, completed January 10th, 1514. And the book was not published, though, till 1520. In other words, it took 6 years to publish it, after Ximenes' death, and did not get into present circulation till 2 years after. In other words, it was finished in 1514. Ximenes died, and it wasn't published till 1520, 6 years later, and then didn't get into circulation until 2 years later, 1522. So his Complutensian Polyglot, that's the name of it, for such was the title, delivered from the Latin name Complutum of Alcala, Complutum, which is of Alcala, was said by the editors to have been constructed from selected manuscripts of great age and accuracy, supplied by Pope Leo X, who was the patron of the undertaking. So the Pope was the patron of this undertaking, of a text that was basically traditional, basically Textus Receptus. Very important indeed that the Pope would give this help and assistance to a text that underlies basically our King James Bible. Very close, this Greek text. Attempts have been made without success to ascertain what these manuscripts were that were supplied. The only result is that we must abide by the assertion of the editors and the character of the work. The Complutensian is admitted to be a fair, but not by any means a faultless edition of the text that had already been in vogue, as is universally admitted, for upwards of 1,000 years. In other words, this was the text, a traditional type of a text. It wasn't perfect, but it was very, very close. What the second thing? That was the first appearance of the Greek text. It was the Complutensian Polyglot of Cardinal Ximenes. Number two, Edward Miller says, but the Complutensian Polyglot was actually anticipated in publication by a Greek Testament in Germany. Froben, F-R-O-B-N, printer of Basel's in Switzerland, of the others in Spain, and wishing to forestall him, that is, to anticipate and to get ahead of him, Strasmus, who was then staying in England, he was a Roman Catholic as well, and pressed him earnestly to undertake the office of editor. So Froben had Erasmus to begin this. Greek that Erasmus received, the first overture, on April 17th, 1515. But such was the haste made that the New Testament was printed before the end of February 1516. And that's the speed by which this printing of Erasmus' Greek text came out. Erasmus had, however, as it appears, made some preparations of his own before he heard from Froben. He seems to have used what copies he could procure, but in a few cases where he either found or supposed the Greek authorities to be difficult or deficient, he translated from the Vulgate into Greek. Well, that's a footnote, and the last six verses of the book of Revelation, some believe he went from Latin into Greek. Others believe that he had the Greek manuscripts, and so this was not exactly the case. But be that as it may, Erasmus' first edition, says Edward Miller, made its way into Spain, where the Complutensian was lying complete, but awaiting the Pope's imprimatur for publication. Strelicka, who was one of the editors of that Complutensian polyglot, found fault with it in the spirit of rivalry, that is, of Erasmus' Greek text. But the fine old cardinal replied, "Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, produce better if thou canst, condemn into the industry of another." So condemn not, rather, the industry of another. So he was not critical too much. He said, "Go ahead and produce your testament, Erasmus, even though we've had ours ready for many years before." We're going to stop here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture." Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. So long till next broadcast, same time, same station. We want to continue this next week. We hope you'll stay tuned to the same station, same broadcast. We're going to continue Edward Miller's Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's a very important guide. It's a very important subject. We have false Westcott and Hort people all around us, and in multitudes in our schools, and we need to have the answer, and this little guide is a helpful answer to a very important problem. Till next time, same time, same station. Until then, we'll see you and say so long. We now present the Bible for the Day of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgant Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 839. 839 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgant Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional Received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@biblefortoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now that's 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you received your Defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. Not another Bible in the world like it. It's deluxe, genuine leather, choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The Defined King James Bible. 1-800-JOHN-10-9 will tell you how to get it. All right, we're continuing on our course through this book, A Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's published by Edward Miller, who was an associate and a helper of Dean John William Burgon. The book was written in 1885, published in 1886. It was written 3 years after Dean Burgon's death, but it's very brief. It's all-encompassing, and you ought to get this copy. It's simply BFD number 743. Number 743, you can find out how to get that. Give us a call. We'll tell you how. All right, we're on page number 9. We're in the introductory chapter. The introductory chapter, it's actually chapter 2, the history of textual criticism. And as we said before, the period of infancy, which is the formation of the received text, and the childhood, that is critical operations before 1830 and 1831. So that's where we are. We're in the infancy. And last broadcast, remember, we talked about the two texts that would come into existence. The Confutentium Polyglot was the first. That was from Cardinal Jimenez. And he, though he completed his work first, he did not publish it before Erasmus' edition. It was completed in the early 1400s. It was completed. It cost quite a bit to do it. Actually, it was started in that time, but it was completed in 1514 and published in 1520, and didn't really get general circulation until 1522. But then the Rasmus and Furbin, the publisher, got out his Greek Testament February 1516. We pick up the story now where Rasmus' first edition made its way into Spain, where the Confutentium was lying complete, but awaiting the Pope's imprimatur for publication. Now, Stumica, he was one of the editors of the Confutentium Polyglot, Stumica found fault with it in the spirit of rivalry. He didn't like Erasmus' text as much as his own, but the fine old cardinal replied, "Would that all the Lord's people were prophets. Produce better if thou canst. Condemn not the industry of another." And that's what Stumica has said, and as quoted in the plain introduction by Scribner. Then Erasmus was, however, attacked by Stumica, and also by Edward Lee, afterward Archbishop of York, and because he had omitted the testimony of the heavenly witnesses in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, as well as on other grounds. Now, that's one of the contentions of the modern critics. They leave out 1 John 5, 7, and 8, a portion of it, a portion of verse 7, and a portion of verse 8. But Erasmus replied that he could not find the passage in his Greek manuscripts, the ones that he had, and that even some Latin copies did not give it. But at length, he promised that if he could find any Greek manuscripts were produced containing the words, he would in future insert them. It's remarkable that the celebrated Vatican Codex B was on this occasion for the first time appealed to on a point of textual criticism. In other words, they said to Vatican B, this is the first time, 1516 or 1517, along in there, where they appealed to that terrible Vatican B manuscript, which was a pollution and a corruption by the Gnostics of the traditional text. Now, 1 John 5, 7, and 8 is in our Bible, our King James Bible, and rightly so, and many have explained why the Greek manuscripts were not as plentiful as in other areas and other verses, but there are hundreds of Latin manuscripts that contain 1 John 5, 7, and 8, the internal evidence, the internal context, and all the other quotations from church fathers shows us very clearly that it belongs there, and I'm glad that Erasmus finally included it. Dr. Jack Mormon has an excellent 15-page article on 1 John 5, 7, and 8. If you're interested in getting it, why, let us know. We'll see that you can get a copy. Call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then Edward Miller continues, in the course of time, the Codex Montfortianus, now in Dublin, was brought forward, and in consequence the passage was printed by Erasmus in his third edition, 1522. Now that is the 1 John 5, 7, and 8. A fourth edition exhibited the text in three parallel columns, the Greek, the Latin Vulgate, and a recension of the latter by Erasmus. In other words, in the fourth edition of Erasmus' Greek New Testament, it had not only the Greek text, the Latin Vulgate, but a recension, a addition of the Latin Vulgate by Erasmus that he made up. So it had three columns, the fourth edition. The last edition, 1535, contained contained only the Greek. And so the final edition of Erasmus in 1535 was only Greek, not Latin Vulgate and not another edition of the Latin Vulgate. Each successive edition underwent correction, but the last did not differ much from the fourth. And then Erasmus died at Basel in 1536. Now, in Basel, Switzerland, I have pictures of it. His tomb is in a Protestant cemetery. It's interesting. He's Roman Catholic, but his tomb, his burial, was in a Protestant cemetery with the headstone. One of my friends, Pastor Kuh, who was from Basel, Switzerland, gave me copies of that burial gravesite and the headstone of Erasmus. 1536. Well, number three, here's the infancy, the construction of the text receptus. Here's the third comment that Edward Miller has, and that is the additions of Robert Stephen, Theodore Beza, and the Elzevirs complete this period. In other words, in addition to the Complutensian Polyglot by Jimenez, Erasmus, then comes Stephen's, Beza, and the Elzevirs. That's the infancy of the Greek text, the infancy that was there. The two first of Stephen published at Paris, respectively, in 1546 and 1549, were most elegantly printed with typecast at the expense of Francis I, and are known to connoisseurs by the title of O Mificama, something like that, from the opening words of impressing an Iconium upon the king's liberality. That word is O Mirificam. I suppose it means it's a wonderful thanks for his liberality and the king giving the money to print it. And then the third infolio came out in 1550. Now here's the Stephen's text of 1550, and for the first time in the history of editions of the Greek Testament, contained various readings, and reference was made in 16 authorities. To 16 authorities in the Stephen's text of 1550. We have that Stephen's text, by the way, that we carry in our Bible for today here at Collingswood, New Jersey, in the interlinear of one of our editors, and he has that 1550 text with the references in the footnotes to these authorities. And this is the text that is still available, 1550 of Stephen's. Differs somewhat from the Beza text that underlies the King James Bible, but not greatly. It's still a traditional text. And so a reference was made to 16 authorities in this, namely the Complutensian Polyglot and 15 manuscripts, amongst which Codex Beza, which is D, now at Cambridge, is thought to have been numbered. Erasmus is not mentioned, although Stephen's two earliest editions were mainly grounded upon Erasmus' readings. And the third, according to Dr. Scrivener's computation, differs from them conjointly in only about 361 places. So the third edition of the Stephen's text differs about 361 places. Robert Stephen did not collate or gather together and compare his authorities himself, but employed the services of his son Henry. So Henry Stephen and Robert Stephen worked together in his Greek New Testament. Edward Miller goes on. His second of readings in the margin in his folio caused great offense to the doctrine and the doctors, rather, of the Sorbonne, and Stephens withdrew to Geneva to escape their enmity. So his record of readings was really something that was not appreciated, not accepted by the ones in the Sorbonne. Well, when he went to Geneva, here he published in 1551 his fourth edition in 1551, amongst almost unchanged in the Greek text from the previous one, but with the one remarkable alteration: the chapters into which Cardinal Hugo of Santo Caro had divided the books of the Bible in the 13th century were in this edition first subdivided into verses. So here we have the history of the verses of our New Testament done by Stevens in 1551, his fourth edition. They had the chapters made by Cardinal Hugo of Santo Caro in the 13th century. That would be in the 1200s. But here in 1551, fourth edition of Stevens, the verses took shape and were inserted into our New Testament. His son Henry said that his father made the subdivisions while riding from Paris to Lyons, probably during the intervals of his exercise. Now, some have facetiously said that he was riding on a horse and he made some of the verses different because he was bumping around. But here, Edward Miller says very clearly it was probably during his exercises and his annual after he stopped riding from Paris to Lyon. His object was to actually to facilitate reference in a concordance which he had in prospect. That was his purpose in doing it. Now, Beza's son did not differ much from Beza's text, rather, did not differ very much from Stevens. He published five editions, Beza did, slightly varying upon one another and ranging from 1565 to 1598. Now, that 1598, by the way, is the edition, Beza's fifth edition, 1598, the edition on which our King James Bible is based. And Dr. Scrivener has mentioned that in his book, and this is the one that we have taken. Of these, the fourth, published in 1589, has the highest reputation, the fifth having been produced in extreme old age. Besides the advantage of Stevens' collections, Beza was the possessor of two very important manuscripts. The one already mentioned, D, of the Gospels and Acts, which was presented by him to the University of Cambridge, and the Codex Clermontianus, D, of St. Paul's epistles at Paris, both of which contain Greek and Latin texts, being therefore bilingual manuscripts. And so this is Beza's contribution. So we have the Competentia Polyglot first, Erasmus next, Stevens then, and then Beza. So these are the ones that in the infancy, the beginning and formation of the traditional text. Then Miller goes on. We're on page 11 of our book, Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. And I hope that you'll stay listening and stay tuned. This is a very important history of our Greek text that underlies our King James Bible. The Elzevirs, Bonaventure and Abraham, brought out two editions at their celebrated press, one in 1624 and the other in 1633. Their text was made up from those of Stevens and Beza. And so the latter edition was remarkable from the expression received text occurring for the first time. Addressing the reader, they said this, quote, "So you have now a text universally accepted or universally received in which we give no alteration or corruption." End of quote. So here, the text universally received is the textum receptum, if you want to say it, or textus receptus, that is there. Textum ergo abis nunc recibus receptum. So textus is the first word of the sentence in Latin, and then therefore it has now, by universally from everyone, received. The first word is textum, and then second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh word is receptus or receptus. And so here's the textus receptus, the received text, universally received by all. So it was a text at that time that was received by all. And it's a good thing. Now, some people have wrongly suggested that since the expression was used by the Elzevirs in their edition of 1633, they suggest that that's the first beginning of the textus receptus. Absolutely false. The first beginning of the received text was in Paul's letters, in James and John, and the manuscripts that came from the very first century, right straight on down from the beginning. That was the origination of the received text. He simply had this word named This is a text that has been received by all. Now, how could anybody think that that's the beginning of the Textus Receptus, just because in Latin he says it's a text received by all, Textus Receptus, or Receptus. Actually, Textus Receptum, if you want to put that ending on it, which is what it is. So if you want to say it the Textus Receptum instead of Receptum instead of Receptus, you can. In fact, it says not Textus, but Textum. It's the ending and the Receptum, Textum Receptum. And we say Textus Receptus Receptus. But that was not the origination of it. He just used it and defined it and mentioned that it was a text that had been received by all. And that was true. Well, let's continue. Their text was made up from those that we said of Stevens and Beza. The text of Stevens, rather, which was afterwards carefully reproduced and reintroduced into the thing. Let me just get my page turned here. It was the text that Stevens had at that time of reproduced by Mill. This reproduction by Mill was later on has generally been taken in England as the standard or the received text. That was the text then from Stevens on the continent, that is by in England, it was the standard text, and that of the Elzevirs has been best regarded on the continent. So in other words, Europe used the Elzevir text as the standard, and in England they more or less used the Stevens text as the standard. Well, the King James Bible was taken from the Beza 5th edition, 1598, actually. The translators, however, as he says here, Miller says, of our authorized version, did not adhere exclusively to any one of the chief editions. When their authorities were at variance, they sometimes, in their interpretation of the received text, followed Beza, sometimes Stevens, sometimes the Complutensian, Erasmus, or the Latin Vulgate. Now, the actual introduction of the Scrivener has said that the King James Bible was based primarily on the 5th edition, 1598, of Beza, although he did refer to other things. In fact, he says only about 190 passages, 190 places, were other things referred to other than Beza's 5th edition, 1598. And so, if you take Scrivener's word on the thing, you'll find that that's the one that is used by the King James translators, Beza's 5th edition, 1598. Let's move on now in this chapter 2 of Edward Miller's Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. And the second division is the childhood. Talked about the infancy, now the childhood of the Greek text and of textual criticism. In the period hitherto indicated, there was hardly any weighing of opposed readings, such as presented themselves, ordinarily accepted with implicit confidence. The free institute or instincts of infancy guided the science mainly along a track that had previously been trodden with continued approval of the church for centuries. It would be reckless haste, not discerning judgment, that would offhand condemn results thus reached. In other words, these copies were traditional copies. These Greek texts were traditional texts. Then he goes on, he says, the copies chiefly followed were known to the specimens more or less exact of what had been preserved in the church as the recognized form of the inspired word. So that's what they had and so on. The received text of the 16th and 17th centuries represented with general but far from invariable accuracy the traditional text of the previous ages of the church. And so that's what came in the 16th and 17th century Greek texts. But on the other hand, the church of later times could not properly rest without ascertaining by all such wide and deep inquiry as was possible whether these instinctive processes had issued in well-grounded conclusions. What was right would be proved to be right in full and free investigation. If candor and largeness of mind and firmness in faith kept away prejudice and narrowness and unbelief. Let me just pause right there in Edward Miller's quotation. They took the historic verses and words of the Greek text that had come down through the ages of the church. And Dean Burgon and Edward Miller examined these things in the light of research and other things, and generally speaking, they found these traditional texts to be the proper text. But Westcott and Hort did something else, and these other people did something else. They brought in false manuscripts, the B and Aleph manuscripts, the Gnostic manuscripts that contradicted the traditional text, and this was wrong of them to do. Let me continue. Point number one, paragraph number one in this childhood is this. In 1657, Brian Walton, W-A-L-T-O-N, afterwards Bishop of Chester, published a polyglot. Here's Walton's polyglot, in many languages, in other words, in one place, to which were appended some various readings, both in the fifth and sixth volumes. In company with some colleagues, he had devoted himself to this work for 12 years, during the dark troubles that had befallen the Church of England. So here it is in 1657. He comes out with a polyglot, several languages in one. He included various readings from the Codex Alexandrinus, which is A, now in the British Museum, which had been presented by Cyril Lucas, or Lucar, to Charles I in 1628. They were composed in his pages, also the results of collations, that is, combinations and collections, of 16 manuscripts made by Archbishop Usher. So that's included as well. And the next year appeared in Amsterdam a New Testament by Curcilius, or Curvellus, marked the Socinian tendencies. Marked by Socinian tendencies. In other words, Socinians did not believe in the deity of Christ, and they did not believe that he was God. And so, in the next year, 1629, this Socinian tendency man came along and published the New Testament at Amsterdam. Soon after, in 1675, Dr. John Fell, Bishop of Oxford, published a small edition in which collations from fresh manuscripts were given and citations were added from the Memphis or ancient version of Lower Egypt, Memphitic is actually what it's called, and the Gothic, which was made soon after the Goths settled on the confines of the Roman Empire. So these are some of the additions that were made at that period of time. Paragraph 2, in addition to that, but a greater and stronger start was made at the end of the 17th century, that would be the end of the 1600s, in large measure through the help of Bishop Fell, who during his lifetime supplied impetus and funds. Dr. John Mill devoted the labor of 30 years to the preparation of a grand New Testament, which was intended to surpass Stephen's in beauty as well as in other respects. So that's what he labored to do. The good bishop's death in 1686 seems to have delayed the work, and it was not until 1707, 3 years after Archbishop Sharp obtained for the struggling editor a stall at Canterbury and royal aid in the presentation and prosecution of his purpose, that the volume came out. So it took a while. Mill himself died just a fortnight after the publication. And thenceforward, the science of textual criticism proceeded upon a new career. So after this Mill and after Brian Walton's polyglot, they took a different twist and turn in this whole idea of textual criticism. And the turn was a bad one, I'm sure of that. Mill only attempted to reproduce the text of Stephen, though he has departed from it in a few particulars. But he added some 30,000 readings and an invariable prolegomenon, in other words, an introduction. He far excelled all his contemporaries and predecessors in accuracy of collation and comprehensiveness of method. Of the criticism of the New Testament in the hands of Dr. John Mill, it may be said that he found the edifice of wood and left it marble. Well, apparently Mill did something better, but there was a different tack at least. Well, the third division of this infancy, and I guess early childhood, I guess it was called, the childhood, I should say, now comes to the grand design of the great Richard Bentley, master of Trinity College. He's the next one in line, which broke forth with lofty promise but never reached his realizations. He included his plan and unfolded his plan to Archbishop Wake, and in a long letter, and in which, after explaining his own studies, he professes the belief that he should be able to restore the text of the New Testament to the form in which it was couched or actually beginning at the time of the Council of Nicaea, in other words, 325 A.D. So that was his goal. He was led in his conclusion and enthusiasm to add, so that there will not be 20 words or even particles differences. So that was his goal, to restore it to the original. After describing the history of the Vulgate and the editorial labors since the invention of printing, he concludes this, quote, "In a word, I find that by taking 2,000 errors out of the Pope's Vulgate and as many out of the Protestant Pope Stephen's, I can set out an edition of each in columns without using any book under 900 years old that shall so exactly agree word for word, and that what at first amazed me, order for order, that no two tallies nor two indentures can agree better." So that's what he says. We're going to pause right here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture." Write us, Bible for Today, Connigswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defying King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. See you next time, same station, next week. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 840. 840 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforttoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now it's 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then, have you ordered your Defined King James Bible yet? Published by the Bible for Today. Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The Defined King James Bible. Now we're continuing now Edward Miller's Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. Edward Miller was an associate and a helper of Dean John William Burgon. He wrote the book in 1885, 3 years after Dean Burgon's death. It came out in 1886, and the Dean Burgon Society has reprinted it. It's available. You ought to get it. It gives you the history of textual criticism from the conservative standpoint rather than the Westcott and Hort type of standpoint, and it's number 743, BFT number 743. Last broadcast, we stopped by talking about Richard Bentley and what he did to try to get this Textus Receptus in the, not childhood, but yeah, the childhood phase, not the infancy, the childhood phase of the textual criticism. He got the Pope's Vulgate and the Protestant Pope Stevens, that's what he called them, and put them together, parallel columns, to try to see what could happen, to see if they could agree together. Let me continue now, see what he did. This was in 1716, and in 4 years, his plan, that is, Richard Bentley's plan, was definitely made up. John Walker, fellow of Trinity College, who had already been employed in collating manuscripts in Paris for the edition, was announced as overseer and corrector of the press. And John Walker continued to labor, and Bentley himself also, so far as other occupations, and the strife with the fellows of the college could allow him. And the edition never came out. In other words, he must have had a battle with his fellows in the college, and therefore he did not print this book, this New Testament, because there was a battle and a strife. He bequeathed a valuable collection of papers to his nephew, who made no use of them, and after the death of the latter, they were published, including amongst several collations, one which he had procured and had got afterwards corrected, of the Vatican Manuscript B. This was transcribed by Wold and printed. So there finally came out some sort of a collection of manuscripts by John Walker, and actually in 1716 or thereabouts, a little bit later, I suppose, after that. A fourth paragraph in development in this childhood of the Textus Receptus and the textual criticism, I should say. By the way, this is deep stuff, you might say. It's heavy material, but it's important material, giving the history of our Greek text. We don't always agree with these who have worked on it, but it does show you some things that have been taken and done in the field of textual criticism and trying to find out what are the words of the New Testament Greek text. A fourth paragraph here, a step in advance was next made by Bengel in 1734. So this is the next phase of the childhood of the textual criticism. A large number of authorities that had now come to light had created embarrassment. Were they all equally to be trusted? Did revision simply consist of a process of marshaling the witnesses on the right and left and then counting heads? Or had these witnesses special characters of their own, which must be investigated and known in order to the formation of a true estimate of their credibility? End of quote. Now, these are simply questions that must be asked. Just because there's textual criticism, does it make it right? No, of course it does not make it right. And that's where the Westcott and Hort theory of textual criticism was all wrong. And these who worked before them, Tichendorf and Tregelis and Griesbach, all these critics were wrong. They worked at textual criticism. They had their documents and they had their reasons. But were they all credible? The answer is no. Let me continue. Bengel, therefore, suggested that inquiries should be made into the origin of each of these other texts, whether taken singly or in parts or associations or families, tribes, and nations. That was his idea. So that they should be reduced to a genealogical table illustrating their several features and relationships. He divided manuscripts generally into African and Asiatic. In his text, he was the first to depart in principle from the received standard. Well, I don't go along with departing from the received standard, and that's what he did, this fellow Bengel. He introduced the division of the New Testament into paragraphs with which we have been familiar. So he's got the paragraphs. First of all, in the 13th century, there were the chapters. And then Stevens, in 1500s, came up with the verses. And now Bengel has got some paragraphs. Bengel was followed by Wettstein, who enlarged greatly the materials ready for criticism. He spent many years, that is, Wettstein did, and collation, that is, collecting all different manuscripts and comparing them. That's what collation is. Including in those labors, about 102 manuscripts. He was the first to cite the manuscripts under their present designation, quoting from A to O of the initials. Those are capital letter manuscripts in the Gospels. And number 1 to 112 of the cursives, those flowing hand manuscripts that they had. And so the nomenclature, the way they referred to the manuscripts, A, B, C, D, E, up to O, for the uncial capital letter manuscripts, and then number 1 to 112 for the cursives. And of course, as more cursives came, well, the numbers increased as well, and the letters increased as well. He attached great importance to the Codex Alexandrinus, or A, the oldest then generally known. He shed much light upon the versions, or early translations, into other languages. He also labored, though it is thought not so successfully, upon the fathers, that is, these church fathers, these early church leaders that had their quotations from Scripture. His services were so considerable that Bishop Marsh was of opinion that he had accomplished more than all his predecessors put together. His edition of the Greek Testament came out 1751 to 52. Most important service was rendered in the collection and collation of existing manuscripts by C.F. Matthai. So here's another man that came along, C.F. Matthai, Andrew Birch, and others. So here's three others. Matthai, a Thuringius by birth, a Thuringian by birth, who held the professorship of classical literature at Moscow, found in that capital a large number of manuscripts. It's interesting. Bought in the 17th century, from Mount Athos, both by a biblical and patristic, that is, the church fathers. So here's a man that got some manuscripts from the area of Russia. He was a man there in Moscow, and he found some manuscripts. It's interesting, even in Russia, there were the Bibles that were there. He collated with an accuracy which has drawn down strong praise, 70 copies. Collated, that is, he compared them one with another to see how close that they were and so on, consisting of these and some others. And besides, he assembled the citations from Holy Scripture contained in about 30 manuscripts of St. Chrysostom's works. So he looked at Chrysostom, who was one of the church fathers, the church leaders, and compared manuscripts that he had and went from there. His revision of the Greek text was exclusively founded upon the manuscripts of his own examining. Whatever they may prove to be its critical value, no difference of opinion can be entertained about the remarkable accuracy of method and scholarship in which he has set a bright example to all who come after him. His collations will remain a treasure for all time. So as he collated and compared, that was important to his work. About the same period after he was doing his work at Vienna, a similar kind in kind but inferior in degree, at the same time after he was doing work in Vatican, he didn't do as well. And Birch, with the assistance of Adler and Moldenhauer, labored in Italy, Germany, and Spain. So here you have all these people laboring, trying to get the Greek New Testament back in shape and do what they want to do. All kinds of people. They just went after it, hammer and tong, you might say. Then there's a fourth division here in the paragraphs and in this chapter of the childhood of the Greek textual criticism. Thus, a large mass of evidence grew up. What seemed vast in the days of Mill was extensively multiplied. In other words, more manuscripts, more different things that turned up, and so they had many more things to work on and work with. And in consequence, another attempt was made to classify the accumulated materials of criticism. John James Griesbach. Now here's the man that was very much a higher critic. John James Griesbach, a pupil of Semler, following out, though with corrections, what his master had begun, and his Semler, urged that three great families of manuscripts existed, each of which was founded upon a special recension or addition. Now, Dean Burgon doesn't agree with this. I don't agree with this, these idea of families. There are no families. Dean Burgon was very clear that they are all orphan children. It's like going into a graveyard, he would say in his illustration, and finding unmarked graves, all unmarked. You could not say this one was with this or came from this and so on. And that was his explanation of this family theory. But Griesbach felt that there were families, and certainly Dean Burgon disagreed. He distinguished these as respectively Western, Alexandrian, and Byzantine. Those were his three families. Now, Westcott and Hort believed also with this man and agreed with Griesbach and the family idea. They added another one, I think, in addition, making a total of four. But anyway, he considered that the testimony of two of these classes should prevail against the third. In other words, he took families of Western and Alexandrian and made them against the Byzantine. Now, the Byzantine, basically, is the traditional text on which our King James Bible is founded. And this man, Griesbach, didn't like the Byzantine family. And so he fought. Now, by the way, the Western and the Alexandrian and the other family totally combined, according to Dr. Jack Mormon, comprised less than 1% of the evidence. B and Aleph and 43 other manuscripts. And here you have so-called three families against the one Byzantine family, and the Byzantine family has over 99% of the evidence that's still in existence. Over 5,210 manuscripts that go along with that particular family, according to Dr. Jack Mormon in his book, Forever Settled. So here they have, they took two classes, Griesbach did, against the third. His theory was no doubt grounded upon a certain, or rather an uncertain, amount of truth. But as he carried it out, it was overthrown by Archbishop Lawrence. And so, to his recensions, as J.G. Reich afterward showed, there was no ground for them beyond speculation. So these recensions, just speculative completely. Nothing that can be termed historical evidence, historical evidence, has been produced for any such operations having been accomplished as would account for Griesbach's classes. In other words, Edwin Miller doesn't agree with families either, that they have these three families, Western, Alexandrian, and Byzantine, or even adding another, a fourth one, which Westcott and Hort added. But Griesbach also carefully edited a Greek testament and thoroughly examined the citations of Holy Scripture made by Origen. So here was Origen, the heretic, the denial of many of the parts of Christology, the doctrine of Christ, and he examined the citations by Origen, who was a very strong higher critic and the wrong type of a higher critic completely. This latter operation, of which the results may be seen in his Symbola Critica, affords a specimen of what must be done in the case of at least the more important ecclesiastical writers before all the evidence adducible can be brought to bear upon controversial points. In other words, Ed Miller is saying there's got to be the ecclesiastical writers, these church fathers, these early church leaders who had in their hands the manuscripts that they should examine to see what they were. Early manuscripts, very primitive manuscripts, right from perhaps the apostolic age themselves. And so the church fathers were very important to Miller. They were important to Dean Burgon. 86,000 quotations or allusions, you remember, Dean Burgon made up in 16 huge folio volumes that are in the British Museum today. So that's what Miller said. Griesbach carries us into the present century. Well, present, that means 1800s for Edward Miller. We're now into the 1900s, the 2000s. We've gone two centuries beyond. He died in 1812, Griesbach did. The work was continued by John Martin Augustine John Martin Augustine Schultz, S-C-H-O-L-Z,
who added, though with much incorrectness, a large amount of materials to the stores previously known. His contribution consists of no less than 616 cursive manuscripts, but confidence cannot be reposed in his productions, as has been shown more than once. And he has a footnote in that showing that it's not accurate. It is remarkable that he modified Griesbach's theory of supposed recensions of manuscripts, including the Western of Griesbach, amongst the Alexandrian, and thus making two instead of three. In other words, he combined Western Alexandrian, two families, that combined, and then, of course, the Byzantine as a second family. So that's what he did. Well, there's no such thing as families. We don't agree with it, but that's at least what this man Schultz did to Griesbach's families. He included the whole of Griesbach's Western recension, from which, indeed, it seems vain to distinguish it by any broad line of demarcation. So he combined what was there. Such was the growth of the science till towards the middle of the present century, that is, he's writing now 1800s. It was the natural development of boyhood, invigorated and enlarged by constant action and extending freely on all sides. There was continually an amplification of materials. He's talking about the textual criticism, the history of it in the Greek New Testament. And operations were progressively prosecuted over wider and wider fields. Theory was pursued less actively and with not so happy results. Different minds succeeded in different provinces, hardly anyone in all. We are thankful, says Dr. Davidson, to the collations of manuscripts for their great labor, but it may be doubted whether they may be often competent to make the best critical text out of existing materials. We should rather see the collation, or the collator rather, we should rather see the collator and the editor of the text dissociated. We should like to have one person for each department. End of quote. And so this man's viewpoint says that we should divide, Dr. Davidson says we should divide the collators, and I mean comparing different manuscripts and lining them up one against another. That should be a separate individual, and then the editor of the text should be completely different from the collator. Well, let's go on to chapter 3. Chapter 3, we're reading from The Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, one of the associates of Dean John William Burgon, written in 1886. Came out in 1886, written in 1885. And Chapter 3, The History of Textual Criticism. Part 2, Contemporary Growth. Now, by contemporary, he means in his own century, 1885, 1886. Contemporary growth. There's Youth, Lachman, and the several doctors of the extreme school, and then Signs of Maturity, other doctors, widening of the basis. So that's what this chapter is all about. And let me continue reading. I hope you're not too bored. This is important. It gives a history. It shows that the textual criticism, which we believe should have stopped and should stop, is continuing to change, is continuing to add new flavors, and later on we're going to see Edward Miller's analysis of the false school of Westcott and Hort, which should be absolutely rejected. Let's go on with what he says in Chapter 3. But now came a change. The impetuosity of youth lacked the patience to await a further growth of the science. He's talking about the science of textual criticism. And to abstain from drawing conclusions till all the evidence had been gathered out of all quarters, thoroughly examined, sorted, and duly valued. A short and easy method of decision was sought and taken. Let me just pause right here. What Edward Miller is saying, and Dean Burgon has said that in his books as well, You don't take a quick, easy fix in this idea of what are the words of Scripture. You don't immediately jump on something because it's easy. You must have all the evidence, all the facts, and that's what is necessary in this whole science, and that's what they did not do. We continue. It was too hard a lot to leave the inheritance of the promised land to a coming generation. If the evidence were too unwieldy to be managed in the mass, some was valuable and some not at all. Why not select the valuable and be guided by the verdicts it gave? In other words, they were so impatient. They had to come out and make something up for this generation in which they lived. It's almost like the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstad. They wanted, through Nelson's publishers, they wanted a text, even though they said, oh, this is not complete, it's not the final, it's just tentative. But they wanted it in their generation, so they came out with it. It changed the text Receptus in about 1,800 places, but this is the theory of these people living in the 1800s as well. So arose the school of extreme textualism. Here's the school of extreme textualism. This is the Westcott and Hort type of school. The first paragraph under this, number one, Lachman, the celebrated philologist and critic, published with the aid of Philip Butman an edition of the New Testament in two volumes, one of which came out in 1842 and the other in 1850, both of them at Berlin, where he was professor. So here's Lachman. Now, Griesbach was bad enough with all of his changes, but Lachman began the extreme textual school. Lachman in 1850 with his, where he was professor at Berlin. He was an apostate. He didn't believe the scriptures to be inerrant and infallible. Let me continue. His first principle, at which he had hinted in a small edition 11 years before, was to discard the readings of the received text as being, in his opinion, only about two centuries old, whereas they conflicted with what he considered to be better authority. So here's the first thing that he did. Throw out the entire received text. He thought it was only 200 years old. Now this was written in 1840. 200 years old would be 1600. He thought that the received text, the traditional text, began with Erasmus in the 1600s. Absolutely false. That's what he started with. Let me continue. His main object, that is Lachman's main object, was to restore, according to the design of Bentley, the text of the 4th century, which he supposed had been lost. For this purpose, he laid aside all of the later manuscripts and confined himself to the few older ones. He also admitted the earliest Latin versions, which existed before Jerome had effected the Vulgate variation. And lastly, he employed the testimony of a few of the oldest fathers, the church fathers. So that's what he did. That's what Lachman did. Thus, in the Gospels, he had the guidance of the Alexandrian A, the Vatican B, the Parisian C, and four fragments, besides an occasional use of the Cambridge manuscript D. The old Italian manuscript in Latin, and the quotation of Irenaeus, these church fathers, Cyprian, Origen, Lucifer, and Hilary. He made a clean sweep of all the rest, a very satisfactory process as far as the easiness of revision was concerned, choosing a voluntary and comfortable poverty of materials with a haughty disregard of the earnest labors of his predecessors. Now, that was very cleverly stated. What he's saying here, it's very easy to him to take just a few manuscripts, simple as pie, throw away all the collations and all the manuscript labors of the predecessors, and go on with something that was simple, comfortable, but a poverty of materials, a poorness. He didn't have anywhere near what he needed. Of his manuscripts, only one, Vatican B, really conducted him into the 4th century. And of that, he could then use only imperfect collations. The most important part of his work has been considered to be the toil which he expended upon the old Latin texts and his vindication of their critical value, though that is not now held to be quite as high as his estimation would make it. So he made labors on the Latin text, the old Latin, but it wasn't as good as he thought it to be. Well, we're going to stop right here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture." Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defiant King James Bible. Call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite reminding you to tune in again next time, same station, same broadcast, next week. We're going to continue this, and we hope that you'll stay with us. As I say, it's not a very simple and easy type of broadcasting, but we're talking about the Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, who was a helper and associate of Dean John William Burgon. It came out in 1886. It was completed in 1885, published 1886. Dean Burgon Society has reprinted it. We're going to continue talking from Chapter 3, the history of textual criticism, and especially this twist, the extreme textualism that Lachmann introduced. And we're going to continue this next week. Hope you'll stay tuned. Until then, same time, same station. See you then. So long.